Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. The Passage is a story about several different groups as they experience a pole shift. The Passage was first written as a script, then later as a short story. It's the short story that's being presented here, with character descriptions from the script. The first parts of the story were presented earlier, during which we followed a young reporter, Danny, as he encountered the cover-up when he tried to get a story printed. Danny then went camping with his girlfriend Daisy as the days of rotation slowing to a stop set in. The couple and some fellow campers take refuge at a local ranch when the pole shift hits. Nettie, the lone survivor at a resort, is pursued by the Groban brothers, who are dealt with in vigilante-style justice. Survivors of a small plane crash share their stories, as do some local townsfolk. Some survivors deal with insanity, not able to adjust to the changes. Seeking help from a secret military camp, the group gets a rude awakening as the military has gone rogue. Fleeing the military, they are leaving the ranch on the run and discover evidence of cannibalism. The plane crash survivors split off from the group and set out to rig an air balloon to return to the East Coast, viewing horrific sights along the way. The ranch survivors reach the river, encountering yet another survival group, which welcomes them. But the rogue military group and the cannibals are both pursuing them. On the run again, the survivors must deal with a wild dog pack. They arrive at a domed city in the woods, under the protection of Zetas and including hybrid children among the residents. A colonel, who has deserted the rogue military unit to help the survivors, sets out to retrieve his family and bring them back to the safety of the Dome City. In this last segment of the story, the young reporter, Danny, and his new girlfriend, Nettie, are introduced to life on other planets, many of whom are frequent visitors to the Dome City. Their guide is Billy, the boy from the ranch, long a contactee and familiar with the routine. Taken on an observation ship piloted by the Zetas, they first visit an amphibious octopus, an old friend of Billy's. On a planet baked by a hot sun, they meet hominoids covered by protective skin plates. Another life form comes as a duo, a living ball of water enclosing an intelligent jellyfish, and Billy goes for a swim. Poisonous planets where the tour group must stay in the ship include a gaseous planet with a manta ray-type life form. The residents of the Dome City soon discover they have new neighbors, also in a Dome City, who are not entirely human. The story continues, with a group preparing to go off-world. Billy is face-to-face with the hybrid boy, having an animated conversation. "Heck, I see them squirm all around so you didn't know where they were headed, but I weren't scared." The hybrid boy puts his hands on his hips and leans back a bit. "They weren't squirming, silly. They were walking. Don't you know anything?" Later, it's evening in the Dome City, and the laser light coming from the center of the fountain is being dimmed slowly to simulate evening. The residents are moving slowly as they take their evening strolls around the pram area on the roof of the top level. Children are being called in from play in the center grassy area near the fountain, complaining slightly, as children will, about having to give it all up and go to bed. Danny and Nettie are walking slowly along the pram, hand in hand. Nettie glances up at his face and says, "Don't you want to go see it?" Danny replies softly, almost under his breath, as though speaking to himself, "Hell yeah." Later that evening, after night has fallen both inside and outside the Dome City, Danny emerges from the entrance of the Dome City. He's walking alone toward an observation ship that is hovering just above the ground, a few feet from the entry of the city. He is striding purposefully. As he nears the ship, Nettie and Billy emerge in their pajamas and nightgown, jogging after Danny. They close the gap so that as they arrive at the ship, they're all together. A walk-up ramp drops from the bottom of the ship, the light from the center of the ship flooding the area. The three quickly walk up the ramp, unafraid. There's a faint light coming from the top center of the ship, as one half the top area is a brown glass that allows viewing in and out. Inside the ship, they emerge from a side corridor, one that goes directly into the circular room in the center of the ship. Danny and Nettie are hand in hand, with Billy walking eagerly just ahead of them. They all take seats side by side around the observation circle. Nettie, still holding Danny's hand, as she senses he is nervous. Billy is pointing toward the floor and the ceiling, talking excitedly. Danny looks up and just stares upward, silently, not moving for a moment. Then he says, wonderment in his voice, "How do they do that?" Nettie turns to face him and says, "The ship is sideways." Billy's chirping in his child's high voice, excited as always by these trips, but contained. He senses that, in spite of his age, he's the leader here, and that this couple needs him to stay steady for them. "We can even go upside down. It's so cool." Billy's pointing at the ceiling as he says this, then pointing at the floor. "Watch, watch, we're taking off." The ship is turned sideways, moving slowly at first and then rapidly picking up speed so that it zooms off into space at an angle to the Earth. The fact that the ship has a clear brown glass floor and ceiling can be faintly seen due to light coming through the ship. On the first planet visited, fog is swirling around a rocky ledge. Danny, Nettie, and Billy are standing in a huddle, though are relaxed and looking around. Billy says, "It could be anything. It could be an octopus. It's an octopus." A large orange-colored octopus raised one halfway up on its many tentacles is approaching. It has no eye and is dry and smooth-looking. The undersides of the tentacles are creamy white. Billy puts his hands on his knees and goes face-to-face, so to speak, with the octopus. He says, "Are you the same guy I talked to last time?" The octopus extends what looks like a pink worm from its underside, and Billy unhesitatingly puts his hand out and lets the talking tentacle wrap around his hand. Billy says, "Shake!" Danny and Nettie have stood stock still during this enthusiastic interchange between Billy and the amphibious octopus. Finally, Danny finds his voice and says, "What's he saying?" Danny steps forward tentatively at first and then with more confidence. "How do you hear what he's saying?" Billy steps back, having let go of the tentacle, and says, "You hear him better when you shake." Danny hesitates for a minute, then says, "Oh," but then spontaneously reaches out a hand to get wrapped in the pink worm. After a moment, he says, "Yeah, we're from the same place, just visiting. You live on the rocks here?" Water can be heard lapping quietly nearby. Billy comes into view, climbing over some rocks in a dry, rocky place. He's talking to Nettie, who's following closely. "And you never know. One time I thought it was a rock, and darned if it didn't move." Nettie is right behind him, with Danny lagging behind, so that his head finally pops into view, looking around before he ventures forth. Seeing nothing alarming, Danny closes the gap between them as they move on down the rock tumble. Suddenly, Billy stops short, Nettie almost bumping into him, as they both look forward without saying a word. Danny comes up behind them slowly, looking in the same direction. All are silent for a moment. Finally, Billy says, "These guys are new." Two short hominoids with thorny plates like a turtle's back covering their bodies are standing before them, several arms' lengths away. They wear little brown-colored coats, are brown-colored themselves and are barefoot. One of the pair is smaller than the others, shoulder height. Suddenly, a large Zeta materializes between the pair and the three visiting, motioning to the pair to come forward, which they do. Nettie seems to come alive, suddenly understanding what one of the pair, the female, is saying, the Zeta translating telepathically for them. Nettie's leaning toward her, saying, "Only at night? How sad for your children. Do they..." And falling silent as the female horn-toed hominoid is quietly grunting. "Oh, well, that's true. We treat fire that way." Some introductions are made inside the ship, where a large living ball is almost filling the interior of the ship. It has veins over its surface, but between the veins one can see liquid in the center. It looks like a living water balloon. Inside can be seen what looks like a jellyfish, very fine and fluttery, not the solid kind with a bell on top that populate Earth's oceans, but more like a mass of spaghetti. Billy steps forward and touches the side of the living water balloon, which presses inward at his touch, as our skin does. "Neato!" The jellyfish moves toward Billy's finger, and he gets an ecstatic look on his face, in communication with the water creature. He looks over his shoulder and says to Danny and Nettie, "He wants me to come swimming with him." Suddenly Billy disappears, his clothing falling to the floor in a heap. Nettie gasps and points at the living water balloon, seeing Billy nude inside the living water balloon, peering out at Nettie. His lungs are obviously working in the water, breathing water. Nettie faints to the floor as a dismayed Danny lunges forward to catch her, breaking her fall. They take Nettie to one of the side rooms to recover. The center room of the ship is circled with side rooms, each with an open archway. Danny has taken Nettie to a room so sparsely furnished that only a table with a center post to support it stands in the room. Nettie is stretched out on this table, coming around. Billy has his pajamas back on, is toweling his hair dry, and running his fingers through his hair to put it into place, like a comb. Billy looks up at Danny and says, "She's doing better than my mom. They had to send my mom back." Danny focuses on Billy and says, a confused look on her face, I thought you were drowning. Without hesitating, Billy replies, "Nah, you can breathe that stuff, but it ain't easy. You gotta get tough, Nettie. My mom means nothing of it." Walking out of the room where Nettie was recovering, the three encounter a buffet of odd-shaped cooked vegetable shapes that has been placed at the side, finger food for those interested. Billy doesn't hesitate, walking right up and popping something in his mouth before the others have even noticed. He turns and looks at the other two over his shoulder, his cheeks puffed out with food while he chomps away. Nettie says, "Oh, that's nice. Looks a bit like asparagus, but, brown." Nettie nibbles a bit, and Danny also puts this and that in his mouth, rolling his eyes up toward the ceiling as he tastes, trying to concentrate on the taste. His face picks up as he realizes that he isn't being poisoned or affronted, and he starts popping items into his mouth one after the other. They're all famished. Nettie's licking her fingers as she turns to scan the interior of the ship. Seeing something through the clear ceiling, she says, "Oh, it's like cotton candy." Danny and Billy follow her gaze and see clouds and puffs in light blue and rose and light yellow floating past the ship as though the ship were standing still and fog or clouds were passing by. Suddenly, what looks like a white manta ray without a stinger comes floating by but pulses his wings so as to stay in place in front of the ceiling panel, looking in at the three passengers in the ship. The ship is hovering on its side above the surface of the planet, but for the passengers, the center of gravity feels like the floor of the ship. They're all in awe, but finally Billy says, "He wants to come in, but he can't. He's dying here, and we die out there. Bummer." The ship suddenly takes off so that the horizon of the cotton candy planet comes rapidly into view. Then the planet shrinks rapidly to where it looks as small as a golf ball, a bit of light-colored fluff light out in the distance, dark on one side but light on the other. Just as suddenly, the ship zooms back, but this time returning to the dark side of the planet. Triangulation is the fastest way from here to there in a spaceship not limited to propulsion. Danny says, My gosh, a perfect boomerang. What a way to travel. As the ship moves into the dark side of the planet, it appears at first that this is all pitch black. Then the three see blinking lights of all colors, and one of the lights draws near the ceiling panel, taking the form of the creature that visited on the day side. It hovers, pulsing its skin wings and pulsing faintly on the light it emits, too, a creature without eyes or ears or appendages except for skin wings like a manta ray. Nettie draws near Danny, who puts his arm around her while she lays her head on his shoulder. Returning to the Dome City, the three walk in through the front entrance. It's very early morning, the city still sleeping and quiet. Billy walks off toward the family quarters, waving goodbye wordlessly, and Danny and Nettie, too tired to do more than a smile and give a half-hearted wave back, walk off to their room. Later, Martha's bringing a plateful of what looks like scrambled eggs and fried potatoes back to one of the tables, set up on the pram for breakfast. A chef in a big white hat and white coat is clanking pots and pans over a sizzling electric plate, arms constantly in motion as he works his magic. Now and then he snatches herbs from this jar or that sack. Big Tom is sipping coffee from a mug, and Tammy is giggling with her new girlfriend as they try to get their dolls to sit straight on the bench beside them. Billy is half asleep, blinking sleepy eyes that don't want to stay open, and not seeing anything, unlike his typical chirpy self. Red and Clara scuff up in their house coats, no longer hiding the fact that they're spending their nights together. Martha glances at Billy with a puzzled look on her face, saying, "Billy, I think you need to go back to bed, son. You look like you need a good night's sleep." Without hesitation, Billy replies, "Yeah, okay, Mom." Billy drags off, leaving Martha with her mouth open. She says, "I was only kidding." Jonah walks up with Ian and his gray-haired assistant. All three are grim, as though concentrating on a serious but not alarming matter. Martha has a decanter of coffee from the communal coffee maker, along with extra mugs, and offers them some coffee. They accept with a nod of their heads. After a sip or two, Jonah, who has been solemnly mulling over his thoughts, says, "We've heard from another city like ours. They seem to be friendly, seem to be doing okay, but there's something odd." Martha jerks her head up, suddenly alarmed, and says, "Odd?" Jonah debates with himself for a moment or two and then says, "Well, I don't think they're entirely human." Martha, clearly relieved that this is the only potentially bad news, says, "Oh, you mean like those super smart kids we've got here with us?" Jonah, warming up and eager to talk about a matter he knows they must share sooner or later, says, "Well, let me just say this. The transmission we got was carrying both audio and video, but they didn't speak. We got the signal by teletype, and in the video they all just stood there smiling and waving, but not speaking. Now, why would that be, unless they couldn't speak?" Martha frowns and looks down for a moment, processing possibilities. "Did they give any indication? I mean, did it look like maybe the mic was just broke, or maybe, Jonah, spilling it all freely now, says, no, that's not all. They had little mouths and no hair at all. But other than that, well, they had big brains. You could see that, big eyes, too, blue and brown and hazel. Beautiful eyes, I'll say that, but not a hair on their heads, and not a word." Martha smiles, relieved and obviously expecting something more bizarre, says, "Did you invite them for supper?" Everyone laughs. Jonah, smiling and likewise relieved at her reaction, says, "Well, yeah, what else was I supposed to do? How weird can it get? I mean, beyond what we're already dealing with, what the heck?" Later that evening, when the lights reflected from the Dome City ceiling is dimming, the city has some visitors. Behind the guardrail along the top level, near the entryway, some tall, dark gray jaders are standing next to something that looks like a large, green-colored worm with two big Muppet eyes on the face end, a tentacle waving. The broad back of what looks exactly like the creature from the Black Lagoon looms behind them, and then the round green hand of a little green man with a dark blue smock comes up over the railing as he's pulling himself up for a view. He points toward the center of the dome, his round face reflecting a smile as broad and simple as the "Have a Nice Day" symbol. There's hardly any motion in the Dome City, just a person or two moving along one of the residence patio areas, that look out on the garden, moving off into a bedroom to settle down. In the center garden, a little boy is bustling across the grassy areas past the fountain, trying to get home before he gets the reminding holler from his mother. Billy has slept much of the day and isn't really ready for bed as yet. He's the last person to leave the park. As he rambles past the fountain, there's a faint splash. Billy throws a comment over his shoulder, nonplussed. "No swimming in the fountains, you guys." A large orange octopus with no eyes pops out of the fountain water and sits on the edge of the fountain, shaking water off of a tentacle. Short story, The Passage. My intention in writing it was to present the complexity surrounding the coming pole shift, where the geological changes and anticipated death rate in humanity have caused the Council of Worlds to schedule other changes for the Earth to occur at the same time. The story does not focus so much on the pole shift and its precursor signs as it does on the human reaction to the changes and the cover-up. David Hawk has warned that most of humanity will not be warned, unless through prophecy and folklore, due to the cover-up by the elite who want only to protect themselves and avoid panic in the populace. And I quote from Theta Talk, Personal Decisions, written March 2002. "We predicted that mankind in the main will go into the pole shift unaware. Most of the world has no access to the media or the internet, and relies on the senses of seers within their culture or their own intuition. As prophets have emerged over the years, warning of the coming earth changes, other cultures, such as Africa, have also been rich in their own folklore, though the West has been unaware of this. The Indians of South America, the tribes of Borneo, the Australian Aborigines, all have their seers and prophets of old. You are aware of the Hopi warnings, the Red Sky story, but this is just a small part of the underground lore among the American Indians. Most hearing at this time, or even in the recent past, about the coming changes are not planning any action at all. As astonishing as this may seem, this is because of the predictable set of steps the thinking process goes through. The first thought is that action should be taken. This requires health, resources, and teammates. Should the individuals have this in youth, energy, and the ability to travel, and others of a like mind, they make plans. Should the individual not have this, in that they are in poor health, old and tired, or blocked from travel due to finances or responsibilities, they move to the next step. The next thought is what to do in the event the warnings are true. For those trapped by either inability to move or finances, the conclusion is either death or slow debility. Should the individual be strong enough to consider the warnings affecting their immediate locale and concluding that life should be horrendous afterwards, they subconsciously decide to allow death to overtake them and their loved ones. This is no different than the decision that those beset with cancer or the final stages of a debilitating disease make. They go with the flow. Should the individual be weak, frightened at the thought, they move to the next step. The next step is denial, and this takes many forms. Denial is usually loudly shouting down the offending message or ignoring it. In any case, it's put aside. Once put aside, the individual moves to the next step. Distraction is the final and lingering step that those in denial take. Work, play, overeating, overexercising, or getting drunk or dopey. Taking up religion, deciding that saving the local songbirds is the most important thing that one could get involved in. Whatever can consume the consciousness. End of the quote from Theta Talk. Let's examine the characters in the story to see where they fell along these four reactions to the pole shift. Professor Isaac was certainly aware of the coming shift and had prepared. He figured this out from an analysis of geological changes and an astute analysis of the message crop circles were delivering. He had a place in the hills and planned to go there when the prophecies came true. And a quote from ZetaTalk again, a foreknowledge written May 1997. The individual may be perceptive regarding geology, inherently logical, and find the towering mountains and separating continents not explained at all by conventional explanations. If they encounter information about wandering poles and coal seams in the Arctic and flash frozen mastodons with green grass in their stomachs in the Arctic Circle, their unease increases. Thus, the subconscious begins to put things together, and they have arrived at a logical conclusion at odds with the explanations prodded by scientists at universities and published in the news. They know something has been left out, and when they hear about the periodicity of the geological changes and the theories about the passing planet, it all falls into place. Thus, inherently logical, independent thinkers may arrive at foreknowledge on their own accord. End of the quote from ZetaTalk. Daisy represents that portion of humanity just unable to deal with the changes and into hard denial and distraction. The editor, Zach Maya, also was aware that something was approaching, but was told the prophecies were false, that the danger would pass. Buying into the cover-up line explained to those asked to assist in the cover-up itself, he was caught off guard and furious about it. And a quote from ZetaTalk, Credibility Issues, written July 2003. What's been put into place to prevent the general public from knowing about the rapid approach of Planet X? When the astonishing size and brightness of the second sun first began being discussed in the media, it was quickly dismissed as either a weather balloon or a sun pillar, and the media told, once again, of a subject that was not to be addressed. When the intense brightness of the dual suns came under notice, as how could it not, in that almost all of mankind is familiar with their sun, this was already a subject known by the media to be suppressed. A sun so bright it could not be looked at even at sunset, a favorite pastime of mankind around the world, and so bright that crops were maturing weeks early. No mention. Then the red dust, the lick of the long tail of iron oxide dust blown toward the Earth by the Earth's gravity, as well as the solar wind, came under notice. Red halos around the moon, red clouds, red dust settling on and blowing about, astonishingly blood-red sunsets, and red dust in the clouds at all times of day, from horizon to horizon. No mention in the media of this worldwide event? None, as this was early on put on the list of topics not to be addressed. Earthquakes had long been expected and a worry in the cover-up, as they were on the increase during the approach of Planet X. In that monitoring stations are few and can thus be controlled, this was considered an easy matter. Drop quakes that occur in unpopulated areas, reduce in Richter size those that must be reported, and tune down any live seismographs so they look benign, not extreme. This works as long as the general public does not suspect, but when they personally feel jolts in their local area or hear from friends of these occurrences, this becomes a credibility issue. Sunrise and sunset times and the apparent position of the sun when light rays get pushed or pulled off course on their way to Earth due to the influence of Planet X, or the odd placement of the moon, which has altered its orbit to accommodate the gravity influence of Planet X between the Earth and Sun, are on occasion noted by the common man. And the inquiries made receive the response of the general public. Those making the inquiry are ignorant. Trust your government and scientists parsing out pat and pre-programmed answers. Signs of the alien presence, such as crop circles laid down in a wink, and in a manner that mankind could not duplicate, or mass sightings of UFOs that can zip about and do maneuvers that mankind likewise could not duplicate, had long been on the media suppression list. An uptick in mass sightings was staged to be simultaneous with the uptick in public notice of the bright object next to the sun. These were strategically placed to draw attention to obvious signs of the presence of Planet X in the solar system. And of course, the media was flooded with inquiries and reports. Thus, even those newscasters and editors previously unaware were acutely aware of this uptick in the subject matter long on the suppression list. In all of this, numerous people outside of the tight circle who formerly knew about Planet X were involved. How would they not? Radio and TV announcers, newspaper editors, and scientists at universities or on the government payroll would be asked questions and needed to know what topics were to be suppressed and what pat answers were to be given, so the number of individuals involved in the cover-up grew. These new enlistees in the cover-up were told this was all for the public good. Nothing bad will happen. It will go away. Panic will bring financial and social structures down, trammel children, open the door to unmitigated looting, and it's a matter of national security, world security, to participate in the cover-up. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. Frank and Jane had been warned by prophecy and folklore, which they took seriously, and thus did not react with shock when the pole shift hit. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Prophets, written March 1996. The periodic cataclysms that the Earth endures are reflected not only in the Earth's theology and the written and spoken legends of her peoples. They are woven into the warnings muttered by prophets. Invariably, prophecy gets packaged for the intended audience, but if one reads beyond the surface for the deeper meaning, one will find a remarkably similar theme. Compare the Hopi Indian, Mother Shipton, and Oashpe descriptions of the forthcoming time of destruction and death with the scientific analysis done by Sitchin and Belikowski, and one will find, time after time, that they correlate. Yet the Hopi had no contact with Mother Shipton, nor she with the Ohio dentist who wrote the Oashpe, and Sitchin and Velikovsky moved in different circles and during different eras. Where has the coming pole shift been reported with some accuracy in ancient or recent writings? The Bible in Revelations is often quoted and is most definitely reporting the occurrence of a pole shift. Hail, quakes, volcanoes, fire from the sky, meteors, and water turned bitter and red with the red dust. Often the appearances from the sky are described as creatures such as a dragon or lion or scorpion. Imagine a frightened populace seeing firestorms descending upon them, whipped by winds, and hearing the earth moan about them as the crust resists separating from the core. The Bible is describing a scene for primitive people without the science knowledge of today and without communications capabilities to know what the rest of the world was experiencing. The Oashpe described the pole shift accurately, and Mother Shipton has placed her warnings with great detail. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. The rogue military unit likewise had inside information and had prepared. And a quote from Zeta Talk, Who Knows, written March 2004. Knowledge of the coming cataclysms, the Planet X body and its path, was restricted to a very few countries such as the U.S., Russia, and Britain. Those considered the world powers at the time of Roswell and needing to participate in any large cover-up of the alien presence. The existence of Planet X as a body due to come into the solar system in 2003 was a matter learned by MJ-12 from their contacts with aliens, ourselves in particular. As the U.S. was nervous that they would not be the only country contacted, they shared this information with their partner countries. MJ-12 as a body included only about 2,000 individuals. These 2,000 members were carefully chosen, including the very wealthy as well as members of government, and the rules strict about profiting from the information they learned or leaking the information. This was considered serious business. Thus, knowledge other than rumor about Planet X and the coming cataclysms was very limited. Many meetings between the Bush administration and heads of state had as their basis bribery and threats to go along with the cover-up, which was explained as necessary so that panic would not ensue. Planet X was explained as something that would pass through the solar system and go on its way, causing no more than the Earth changes experienced to date. It should be borne in mind that most countries do not have the ability to peer into space, the space station and Hubble and probes restricted to the U.S. and Russia. Observatories are expensive, and as funded enterprises, the wealthy can exact the equivalent of national security oaths from astronomers working there. These restrictions and a few obvious assassinations keep this information close, not in the public domain. End of the quote from Theta Talk. Contactees such as Martha and Billy received warnings via visitations and thus were likewise strong in the face of the changes. And I quote from Theta Talk, Foreknowledge, written May 1997. Many people, when encountering information about the coming geological changes due to occur just after the millennium, feel that the information strikes a resonance with them, is something they somehow knew about all along, and due to this connection with their own internal knowledge, these individuals begin to seriously prepare for the changes. Such foreknowledge is due to information pathways being in place. The individual may be a contactee, and due to the frequent visitations that serious contactees receive, the subject invariably comes up. Not all contactees have foreknowledge of the coming cataclysms, as this information is not imparted due to our wishes, but because it fits into the context of the call given. They may also have foreknowledge from birth, actually prior to birth, as due to discussions with the birthing envoys prior to selection of their next incarnation, the subject came up and they pressed for an incarnation wherein they would have a significant role. Such incarnations allow alien visitors answering the call to cut to the chase, as you say, and discuss the issues right off. Such pre-birth knowledge going into the incarnation finds the humans vaguely aware that there is a role that they have chosen that's out of sync with the routine flow they see about them. They have had a sense of preparing all their life for something, but are not consciously aware of what the something is. When they encounter others aware of the coming cataclysms, the overwhelming earth changes and concurrent societal changes, they suddenly understand the mission. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. The scenes described by Mark, seen from their small plane and heard on the radio, are typical of the last-minute panic the Zetas have described. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Last-Minute Panic, written August 1995. In spite of denial and suppression of talk about the coming cataclysms, when the Earth slows and then stops in its rotation, the truth will be known. How could it not? There will be in general two responses in those previously unaware or in denial, flight and paralysis. Paralysis needs no explanation. Sitting at home and drinking the liquor cabinet dry, baking a cake and throwing a party just to pass the hours more quickly in a diversion. In paralysis, no attempt to deal with the impending disaster is made. Of course, those who remain in denial, even when night does not become day, or the day refuses to end, are in a type of paralysis. There will be those who go to work and attempt to shop and attend social functions as though nothing were amiss. Activity and familiarity tend to comfort. Those who sense the seriousness of the situation will attempt to flee. If they have been informed but scoffed, they may know what to do and where to go and attempt to do so in great haste. Belongings and even loved ones are left behind. Doors left wide open, heading for the hills, for cover, to escape the city. If they have not been informed, they will attempt to flee anyway, going in all directions. Some, faced with a baking sun that will not relent, will crouch under structures that will ultimately crush them, knowing no better. Some, hearing the earth moaning beneath them, will take to the air or sea if possible, only to find themselves eventually dashed out of the skies by hurricane winds, or crushed under waves hundreds of feet high. Imagine the situation. On one side of the earth, the sun is not setting. Temperatures rise. Machines break down. The telephone lines are jammed, and highways blocked with disabled cars. Those on foot don't last long in the heat. Essentially, all is heat loss. People will seek a cool spot and wait for whatever comes. On the other side of the earth, perpetual night is reigning. Here activity is not heat-locked, but is rather sleep-locked. Businesses do not open as everyone is confused. Are the clocks broken? Telephone lines are also jammed, and lack of coordination is evident everywhere. The night shift goes home, eventually, exhausted, but the day shift never shows up. The traveler attempting to drive somewhere finds gas stations unattended and cars out of gas blocking the roads. So those becoming aware of the situation at the last minute do not go anywhere, essentially, whether they want to or not. End of the quote from Theta Talk. Another goal of the story was to show the polarizing toward good or evil that occurs during any transformation period. Those who have never grown up, remain spiritually immature, and are thus service to self-oriented, sense they are losing the battle for turf and will be removed, and get vicious and obvious in their maneuvers in the last days. The Grogan brothers in their looting rampage and the rogue military, represented by General Flood's unit, show this side of the polarization. Those not inclined to be service to self deserted General Flood's unit. Daisy represents an undecided individual, spiritually immature, who by her actions is separated from the service to other groups led by Ian and Jonah. She was not alone, as others in Ian's Bridgewater settlement tired of the intensity towards service required in a service to other community. Where this type of separation occurs more rapidly after the pole shift, it's happening today to some degree. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Separate, written February 2002. In the world that man currently lives in, they cannot easily group by orientation into service to other or service to self groups. This is a point of confusion during this transformation time. A group of service to other individuals seeking to separate will soon find themselves being visited by those wanting to take advantage of them. A group of service to self individuals are the first to arrive in such a setting, as this is ideal to their way of thinking. Most service to other individuals have family and friends they are intertwined with, who have mixed orientations, are undecided. Then enter the rule of law, societal law, which requires these relationships to continue. Governments do not want groups to isolate themselves and consider this a great threat. Look to the rage with which the FBI invaded isolated groups a decade or so ago to see how this is viewed. They consider all citizens to be their property and insist on the entanglements that are wrapped around the individual from childhood on remaining. One must have schooling, be prepared, get a job, be taxed, produce offspring that are likewise controlled. The rage over abortion is an example of how far this sense of control and the importance to those power mad can go. There must be no escape. So how does this change after the shift, during the transformation? First, isolation and separation from government control is automatic. Governments will lose control utterly, and isolation is the norm, not something sought. Thus it comes down to how a small group or a community might separate and polarize. Think of your family, how family members or workforce members find compatible associates and tend to migrate toward them in their free time. If the controls over family support or showing up for work were gone, this would occur increasingly and become full-time. You have the service of self-minded who go off to loot and look for the weak. They thus are removed from strongly service to other groups, as these groups tend to cooperate well with each other and defend themselves. Now you have the undecided, remaining with the service to other or straggling along on the periphery of the service to self. In a service to other environment, there is much serious discussion and expectation that all will work hard for the general welfare. Undecideds find this grim, no fun, and the first opportunity peel away and set off on their own. Thus, if doing well, they establish their own communities, and if not doing well, die off. To a great extent, the everyday life that man has today in civilized countries will not exist. Disease, infections, and accidents will strike quickly and decimate survivors. Thus, service to other communities will increasingly find themselves the survivors among survivors. When this occurs, they will find themselves in contact with high-tech communities of humans and hybrids living together. At this point, if not earlier, by being assisted unannounced, they will find their lives improved. Thus, to imagine this polarization, this separation by orientation, remove the rule of law, the demands of society, and carry forward the natural trends you see among people today. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. The high-tech communities where Zeta and hybrids and humans live side by side is also depicted in the story. In reality, some individuals will find themselves quickly in a high-tech community for the service to others, but most will find slight interaction with high-tech aliens. And I quote from Zeta Talk's Hybrid Homes, written July 1995. Will our hybrids pick up residence on Earth after the cataclysm? But of course, in service to other communities. This will be selective and cautious, and in most cases, human societies, as much as they can function after the cataclysm, will be unaware. Some of our hybrids will live alone or with us, the full-blood Zetas, and in some cases will live also with humans. The standard of living in these communities will be much higher than you now enjoy, very high-tech, as you say. The hybrids will expect to live as they are now, with automated food production and control, temperatures, and light. Science is advanced, and exploration in the sciences is an occupation of almost everyone. The forms of energy and travel will approximate those we, the Zetas, and the hybrids enjoy today. The service to other hybrids and Zetas will adopt service to other humans into our midst to some degree. Where there are communities of humans only, who are living in the service to other orientation, these technologies will be given as a gift. Communication, or the sharing of news, is complete and without censorship. Community activities are determined by vote, much as we have described how the Council of Worlds now polls the opinions of people on Earth. Each has a voice, and there is no need to rush to the polls. Most human societies, even when operating under the service to other orientation after the pole shift, will remain strictly human. Some communities solely composed of our hybrids will spring up on Earth after the shift, in areas greatly devastated or on new, uninhabited ground. As our hybrids are not entirely unknown today to some humans, there will also be mixed communities. In these, it is expected that humans will share the technologies enjoyed by our hybrids, thus essentially being adopted. Of the whole, these communities will not be that numerous. Recall also that the humans adopted will have undergone a great devastation and be essentially homeless. Where humans have prepared for the cataclysm and are operational afterwards, direct adoption by our hybrid communities is not likely. Humans desiring to form service to other communities in preparation for the cataclysm should not concern themselves about physical proximity to the Zeta hybrid communities. We will find you. We do not have our future locations picked out, as this will be dependent on many things. The free will of humans will make many changes between now and then affect the result. Your focus should be on your convenience and being able to achieve your goals, which will not be all that easy. Convincing humans to give up many conveniences, to live in a more primitive state, just in case, is not all that easy a matter. Focus on what you can achieve, and we will be in touch. We will come to you. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. The Zetas have stated that after the pole shift, many people will go insane because of the impact on their lives. 43% of all survivors are expected to be affected to some degree. In the story, this is represented by Tammy and Brian. And in the story, Billy leads the group to what is called a life form orientation, an introduction into the strangeness of life elsewhere. The Zetas have stated this type of orientation is being done today, and I personally was given such an orientation. Just as Nettie fainted at a certain point, I fainted for the first time in my life during one of the life form orientations. The Zetas have also predicted that many communities will be led by children after the shift. This is represented in the story by the role Billy plays, where he's the prime instigator for greater alien-human interaction. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Led by Children, written January 2002. Many children are being born at this time, quite young, to face the cataclysms that will occur before they reach their teens, much less adulthood. Why would this be the plan when such children would be likely to be in shock, neglected, and unable to lead, certainly? These special children are in an optimal position to lead, contrary to mankind's understanding. Why would this be so? Children, souls incarnating into the young, are without the burden that human adults have assumed of preconceived notions and the societal need to conform. They're open and comment upon what they see as reality, not with the suppression that society imposes and which becomes automatic and adopted by adults who must conform in society. Likewise, these children have stamina and health, as in truth the human body is strongest prior to the age of 20 or so and declines afterwards. Thus survival groups, stunned by what has happened and in despair over being abandoned and lied to by their governments, in shock over the adjustments to their prior lifestyle, and depressed over the adjustments that must be made, will be led by these children, who will see resources and avenues not apparent to their parents and caretakers. They will find each other and communicate and create bonds between groups that the adults would not think possible. They will be the visionaries of the future among human survival groups to a degree that would stun their parents now. Thus, led by children is a phrase that will become a reality in the near future. They are on the increase now to serve, as during the shift when most of humanity will be stunned and hurting and the lack of leadership crying for natural leaders to step forward. Of course, the children will not be the only ones leading, as there are many natural leaders among the adults, but the relative youth allows them more flexibility, not the least of which is that adults may resist other adults, getting into posturing, but will take a child's suggestions as just that. Children have ways of influencing their elders which the elders scarcely take note of, but an analysis of the process shows that the child is leading. End of the quote from Zeta Talk.
President of Troubled Times Incorporated. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping mankind survive during troubled times when self-sufficiency may be the only answer. Our organization offers a twin set CD of survival information at cost to the public. The CDs are in hypertext and PDF format, two popular browser formats, and contain all the information collected by the massive Troubled Times website. The CDs allow you to browse this information offline at your leisure. The cost of the twinned pair is $4.10, and this includes postage. You can also get the survival booklet, a hip-sized booklet of the gift of the Troubled Times advice, for just $5, including postage. We offer a popular combo package for $7.50 that includes both the CDs and the booklet with the lower postage expense reflected in that price. Send for your copies today to start making practical plans for your and your family's survival. Just click on the $4.10 CD link at www.zetatalk.com, and your copy will be on its way.
That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought. Those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.